Well, 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 Noel, old friend, here we are on Ridiculous History, about to dive into a topic that I find endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, we're going to dive into a sea hole.
What is a sea hole, my friend?
A cult hole.
Mm-hmm. Yes, or a cave hole.
All right, yeah, when I say a sea hole, it's more of a sea rectangle, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's a cave, a man-made cave with a rectangular door that was one of the first ever homes to America's original doomsday cult.
My name is Ben. This Ridiculous History, as I think I just mentioned. And, of course, we are joined, as always, with our super producer, Casey Pegram. So, Noel, the rumors are true. We're talking about a legitimate doomsday cult. And, you know, in another show that you and I do together, we run into cults on a... on a, like, bi-monthly basis.
Semi-regular.
Yeah.
But on Ridiculous History, Ben, we don't deal in rumors. What's the brass tacks, my man?
Yes, the brass tacks take us to a place very familiar with everyone here, known as Philadelphia. See, the Cave of Kelpius is tucked away in a remote section of the modern-day Fairmont Park in Philadelphia, but it's very old. You could walk past it and not really notice the history now, unless you went inside, right?
That's right. In fact, a lot of places that describe it say, even if you know where you're going, you're probably a lot less likely to find it rather than just stumble upon it, because mm-hmm. it is in like a heavily wooded kind of Blair Witch kind of environment, right? It's along the banks of the Wissahickon Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1694, a very smart fellow, a scholar, something of a New Age mystic type, right? Mm-hmm. By the name of Johannes Kelpius, he brought 40 of his followers, all learned men, from their home in Transylvania to the newly settled Germantown, Pennsylvania, because they were escaping religious persecution, because they weren't playing by the book.
No.
The good book.
Yeah, yeah. They had their own playbook spiritually, and they believed that the end was nigh. Johannes Kelpius was born Johann Kelp in Transylvania, as you said, in 1667.
Is that nominative determinism? Do you think his family, like, were maritime folk?
I wonder. That's a good question. You know, also what I noticed is, given the timeline, this is way before Bram Stoker made Transylvania a scary place.
That's true.
Isn't that weird?
That's going to come up in the next episode we're going to do, I think, as well.
Oh, it is. It is. Stay tuned, folks.
Spoiler alert. But yeah, so he brought these 40. They had, I think he himself had, you were starting his chronology. He was born.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then he was educated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he completed his education at Bavaria's University of Altdorf, and at the time it was a very respected, highfalutin institution there in Europe. And his name change occurred not because of vanity so much as because the common practice for scholars at this day and age was to Latinize your name. So Kelp became Kelpius.
Would mine become Brownius?
That's interesting.
Bolinius.
Bolinius, Brownius, Pegramius, Pegramius?
Pegrumius.
Pegrumius.
That sounds good to me.
So while he's at university, he becomes attracted to, acquainted with, enamored of a religious movement known as Pietism. This was a reaction against the Orthodox Lutheranism of the time, and then it later expanded to include beliefs that, you know, as you said with his followers, beliefs that were considered heretical, strange, forbidden knowledge, possibly occult. And as he became more and more immersed in this world, he also began to gather different people around him. He was a follower of a guy named Johann Jacob Zimmermann, and Zimmermann formed a small group of like-minded people called the Chapter of Perfection.
It's true. And I saw him described as such, as a noted German mathematician, astronomer, and defrocked Lutheran minister. And you know what happens when they defrock you, right?
Right.
That's like when you pull all the medals off the general's chest, you know?
Yeah.
And send him with his tail between his legs.
You are no longer allowed to practice the spiritual beliefs, right?
Give me your badge and gun, detective.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
And this group, led by Zimmerman, that Kelpius is a member of, he, right around this time, he's maybe 20 years old, and most of the people in the group are around his age. And the group believed that there was a new spiritual age imminent. Their version of the 1,000-year idea of Christ returning, and that they had to prepare for this. And I love that you mentioned Zimmerman being an astronomer, because that was the quantitative basis for a lot of his arguments.
That's right. And I just want to say, too, Zimmerman was kind of the one who initially, unless I'm reading this incorrectly, initially put together this expedition. You know, it was like a six-month boat trip.
Yeah,
from Europe to Germantown or Philadelphia area, but he passed away before it could take off.
Right.
So Kelpius kind of became the new de facto leader of the group.
Yeah, the Neo Zimmerman, right?
Right.
Yeah, this is an interesting part of the story that I don't know if you found anything, but I couldn't solve one mystery about this. Estimates say that around 1692, this group, the Chapter of Perfection, received an offer of free land in Pennsylvania, in Germantown, where you mentioned, and a free boat ride over, but they received it anonymously.
Now, I had read somewhere that it was from the governor of Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
Who was trying to, you know, encourage new settlers to come in, and offers of religious tolerance was a big part of early Pennsylvania settlements, right?
Oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Maybe it wasn't the governor, though, but I know there definitely was an effort from the powers that be in this particular part of the colonies to attract more religiously free-thinking types. Mm-hmm.
And to populate the land with Europeans.
Of course.
Too. Yeah, I think you must be spot on. You know, I love the tantalizing hint of an anonymous person, but I bet you are 100% correct that it was the governing structure of the time. But as you said, Zimmerman, right around the time they're about to leave for what would become the United States, Zimmerman dies in August of 1693. Kelpius becomes the commander. He leads them, he leads his group of 40 people to a ridge there above the Wissahickon Gorge. That's such a fun word to say, too. And there, along the 40th parallel, Kelpius builds a 40-foot square tabernacle because in their philosophy, in their understanding, 40 is like the best number. It's the most important magical number.
I did just find it was William Penn who apparently invited the group. And William Penn was the governor, and I think kind of governed Pennsylvania like its own
autonomous thing.
Yeah, that's right. So, Ben, do you know what millennialism is?
Millennialism, from what I understand, is the belief that the world will expire at a significant date, either completely end or some great change will occur. Is that correct?
That is big time correct. And that is what these folks were all about. You may have seen the Fox television show, kind of a bit of an X-Files ripoff called Millennium, but it was all about like the end times and the end of days and stuff. But there's a couple of different interpretations of millennialism, and I'm taking this from the New World Encyclopedia. One of them is this notion that Christ will come back to earth and establish himself an entire new kingdom and rule for 1,000 years, at which point will come the reckoning, you know, or some kind of culling of those that deserve to stick around and those that have to go. Then there's another version of it where the second coming occurs with an immediate culling of the wicked through some sort of cataclysmic event to, you know, trigger a new world order kind of thing. But whichever one they believed in, the fact is there was a very specific part of the Bible that was a foundation of this belief system in general, and it's obviously the Book of Revelations. And there is a particular passage that gave this group one of their many monikers. They had a handful. And the passage is called The Woman and the Dragon. and it's from Revelations 12 through 16. I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on its head. Skip a little bit. Then war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. So it's this idea of hell on earth, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And what were some of the names of their groups, starting with the one that was taken from this passage that they so held so dear?
They were collectively known by several names. The weirdest one was the Woman of the Wilderness. 40 guys calling themselves the Woman of the Wilderness.
It wasn't even like the
women,
the collective of the Woman of the Wilderness.
The Society of the
Woman. It's just the woman.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about it is history doesn't seem to completely agree. Some people tell you they were just collectively called the Woman in the Wilderness. And then you'll find a couple of other places where they say they were the Society of the Woman of the Wilderness, mm-hmm. which makes more sense.
But my favorite, though, is that they were the Hermits of the Ridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? That's like the name of a D&D party, you know? Mm-hmm.
Or the name of like a good old folksy prairie home companion story.
That's true. Yeah. The old Hermit of the Ridge. Because the place we're talking about today, the cave of Kelpius, folks in Philadelphia area just call it the Hermit's Cave.
Yeah. Yep. And the legend has it that Kelpius lived and meditated in this cave built in the hillside of the ravine, and that it was, you'll hear some people say that it was just an old spring house where occasionally Kelpius or some other person would spend the night.
Yeah, and then he would return to his summer house, mm-hmm. you know, in warmer. No, I'm kidding. A spring house, like a well house or something, like some sort of enclosure mm-hmm. where there would be a well and a source of fresh water, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. So while they established themselves in what became known as Hermit's Glen or the Hermit's Cave and the Hermit's Glen, they also made an impression on the town. There's a nearby road you can find today, we believe, called Hermit Lane. So this is established. It's not very well known, I'd say, outside of Philadelphia, but it has left a physical trace on the city.
That's right, and there's actually a fantastic article from Atlas Obscura called mm-hmm. Cave of Kelpius, where America's first doomsday cult awaited the end of the world, and there's a little sidebar on it that has the coordinates of the cave, because it's not exactly something you can Google map to, because
right.
again, like we said, you kind of just have to wander around and find it yourself, but it is technically on Hermit Lane.
Yeah, yeah. You'll have a hard time getting mail sent there. But,
exactly.
But you can find it with the coordinates, and the space, from what we understand, the meeting space of the hermits or the society or the woman in the wilderness included the following things. They had a rudimentary observatory where the monks would practice astronomy. And this is thought to be the first observatory built in the New World, the quote-unquote New World.
Yeah, and astronomy was a huge deal for these folks. And there's a sense that it was because they were on the lookout for, I'm going to call them extraterrestrials, but I almost want to say like heavenly, like angels or something.
Signs like, and wonders.
Signs and wonders, because yeah. they really did believe that, you know, like that passage, that maybe the devils were going to come flying down from the sky. Mm-hmm. What's that line in, I think it's Batman v Superman, where he says, turns out the devils don't come from below, they come from above.
Yeah, that's
Kelpius,
right.
You know, he seemed to have that in mind when he was looking. And it was a very, for the time, advanced telescope, right, Ben?
Absolutely, yeah. They were able to have a very clear view, because we have to remember, it's very easy for us nowadays as a species to see a mystical belief that one group or person has and take that to mean that we should dismiss their scientific beliefs. It's not the case. These things exist hand in hand, and to these people, they were not contradictory, sort of the same way that Isaac Newton had some really out there esoteric beliefs.
Yeah, or that Rudyard Kipling was kind of a racist.
I would say absolutely, right? Oh, God, what a terrible person.
The interesting thing, too, about Kelpius is that we don't know – we don't have a lot of primary sources on him. So there's a lot of conjecture. And when you go to the cave of Kelpius, there's no artifacts left behind. There's no furniture. It's just out there. There is a marker that was put there by a little society. We know a bit about their philosophy, don't we, Ben? Rosicrucian, the Order of the Rosicrucians.
That's
right. Or the Rose Cross.
That's right, Noel. The Order of the Rosy Cross built a – marker for this. And, you know, if you went back in the 40s, you would see some stuff in the cave. Like, you'd see a chimney. That was there for a while.
I think it got vandalized or damaged beyond repair, and so they removed it. But I saw this cool video that it was cool for a minute, and then it started to lean a little heavily into some not true stuff.
Right.
But it did have a really cool walkthrough of the cave, and I don't know if this was added later. I mean, it's certainly possible, but there's a cross and then an upside-down cross right next to it. And the idea being that, like, you know, one is the sign of Christ, the other is the sign of the devil. And then throughout the space, there are some other kind of strange coded messages. But one thing we do know is real and not just, you know, passersby having a laugh, is this Rosicrucian marker that identifies Kelpius as being the first Rosicrucian in the New World.
Yeah, it's legit, and the chronology works out. The thing about these semi-secret orders, these mysterious esoteric groups, is that they can often just appoint themselves in, you know, appoint authority to themselves. But according to the tradition, he's not only the first Rosicrucian, he's the first Rosicrucian master, right? There's some neat articles about this. Like, you can find a lot of local Pennsylvania history places. I really enjoyed the explorepahistory.com story about the marker. And you can read both the modern marker that is in place that tells you about the Kelpius community.
That's the newer one. That's right.
That's the newer one. And then you can see the other older stuff that's also spread around there. It's a shame about the vandalism. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
That really broke my heart. But we forgot to mention, okay, so they're millennials. Millenarians.
Same difference.
There we go. And they had a very specific time frame for this last judgment. And it was 1694, the year that they all got together in this area, right? Or when they really doubled down. But that time came and went. See, that's the problem with a lot of doomsday cults. They'll predict something, and then that moment will pass, and the world will spin on as it will, and then they have to find a new way to understand this. So according to the Chestnut Hill Local, with the title The Rapture That Never Came, The Story of the Hermits of the Wissahickon, according to them, when 1694 came and went without a last judgment, Kelpius and the society said, you know what, we're going to look toward the year 1700. Certainly, the advent of this new century will bring about the end of mankind and the return of Jesus Christ.
I mean, you got to hope, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hope for something better, right? And the year arrived. There was not, from their perspective, a return of a Messiah. And then they started to, I don't know, the members began to get tired of these continual claims.
Yeah. Well, have you heard of the Church of the Subgenius, Ben?
Yes.
It's sort of a joke cult kind of, I mean, yes, I'm going to leave it at that. It's sort of a joke cult where they worship supposedly this like 50s clip art, like dad looking head with a pipe called Reverend J.R. Bob Dobbs. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental concept of Subgenius is slack. But a big part of them is they have this thing called X Day, where supposedly these aliens are going to come and do very much a thing that I think the Order of the Hermits, or whatever you want to call them, were hoping for. But they got the date wrong because they looked at it upside down. The big dummies, you know? And that's just sort of like a little bit thumbing of the nose at a lot of these death cults, where they always get something a little off. And then, you know, oh, it'll be next time. Just keep stick with us, you know?
And again, in the defense of this group, of Kelpius's community, they were not super aggressive, crazy, violent, aggro people.
No, like you said, the community even kind of enjoyed their presence. They were very gentle, types, it would seem.
Yeah, it would seem so. And then as they began to, as enthusiasm at least began to taper off, they saw the end of the cult becoming more and more immediate. Because Kelpius, it turns out that living in caves with with crushing low temperatures, especially in the winter months, turns out it's not good for you. No matter how well-informed you are, or no matter how talented of an astronomer you are.
No, we also find that a lot of times people that are, like, really driven and obsessed with the quest for knowledge sometimes don't take the best care of their physical vessels because they're so busy doing all the maths and stuff, you know, that they just, who's got time to eat or, you know, put on a blanket.
And Kelpius became ill with tuberculosis. Around 1705, he had to go away from the tabernacle area and move into the home of a former member who had already left the organization in Germantown proper. And he lived for about three more years.
I believe he was early 40s when he passed away. Seemed quite quite unfortunate and young.
Yeah. He never really recovered from that bout of tuberculosis, and he died in 1708. His followers returned. They took his body to the tabernacle. They buried him in the garden, and they had a ceremony where they released a dove as they were lowering him into the ground. The society itself survived for about another 10 years or so, but without the same drive or enthusiasm. It was, at some point, it got down to just six hardcore believers. But here we end some of the facts and we get to some of the real juicy stuff, the legends.
Oh, man, this is fun stuff. This is much more in the realm of our other program, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. But it is just so much fun.
So great.
So one of Kelpius's most trusted confidants and followers was a guy by the name of Geisler.
Mm-hmm.
Was his first name?
Daniel.
Daniel Geisler. And he was kind of trying to adhere to the mystical guru's last wishes as he was on his deathbed, right?
Mm-hmm. Because Kelpius gave Geisler a very particular artifact. It was a box, but it was locked.
Yeah, I like to refer to it as the mystery box. I think of that thing in Mulholland Drive, you know, where they pull out the box and the camera zooms in and then everything gets real weird.
Yeah.
It's like that, you know. No one knows what's in the box, but there's a fantastic article from The Voice, the Philly Voice, in fact, called "Did Wissahickon Hermit Have Fabled Philosopher's Stone?" Huh.
Yeah.
Ben, remind us, what's the Philosopher's Stone?
Ah, yes. Well, in the most common way to put it without making it a crazy metaphor for something is that it's a legendary substance that you hear a lot about in alchemical writings that can turn things into other things. It can transmute substances. So you'll hear stuff like turning lead into gold, for instance, right?
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it sounds like a great stone to have, right? It may not be a physical stone in all the stories. Sometimes it's just the substance, and sometimes it's thought to be more of a symbol of a mystical term for the great work in every effort by alchemists to discover this substance or create it or reproduce it. Those efforts were collectively known as the great work.
The great work.
So the idea that a mystic like Kelpius would possess this philosopher's stone is amazing and astonishing to anybody who was still searching for it. Now, we have to keep in mind, you know, this is the early 18th century. So belief in alchemy is still, you know, much more widespread than it is in 2018, I would say.
So Kelpius is on his deathbed in the throes of the dreaded tuberculosis. This was the early 1700s, I think 1708. And his confidant there, Geisler, I'm just painting a picture here, kneeling by his bedside and saying, Master, what can I do for you to ease your suffering? Anything. This is totally how it went down. And to that, Kelpius says, well, there is one thing, my son. Come closer. You know how they always do that when they're on the deathbed? Then come closer.
I don't have this strength.
Come closer. I want you to take hence this box, my arcanum, and I want you to throw it in the river. the Schuylkill River? How would you say that?
Schuylkill.
Schuylkill. Yeah. I want you to throw it in the watery depths of the Schuylkill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to this, our boy Giesler.
He said, sure.
Yeah. Well, of course, anything. And then promptly didn't do it.
And the great part of that legend is when he comes back and he's like, all done, boss. Kelpius.
He says, come closer.
Yeah, he raises himself up and he expends what little energy he has to point at him and say, Daniel, thou hast not done as I bid thee, nor hast thou cast the casket into the river, but hast hidden it near the shore.
And then he was like, ooh, you got me. You got me, boss. I was going to try to pick that lock and...
And so now he's convinced that his master has superpowers.
He's definitely convinced, and so he finally does it. And what a disappointment, though, this guy was.
Yeah.
What kind of follower are you if you can't just follow simple instructions of a dying mystic?
It's a dying wish.
Seriously, man.
So what happens, Noel, when he actually does throw it away?
Well, according to this account, which was given by Giesler to a guy by the name of Henry Muhlenberg, who the Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania, was named after. And also he started the North American Lutheran Church, or he was a big force in establishing the North American Lutheran Church. This is, again, from this Philly Voice article. It's a very fabulous account because he says, and this is all, you know, written down, that as soon as he threw it in the river, it exploded.
Yes. Yeah. Is it – so help me get this straight. Did it explode? Was it a flash of lightning? Did it come from the box? That's what it almost sounds like.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's written as though it produced some kind of alchemical – reaction, some sort of elemental, that's the word I'm looking for, reaction, because it's described as producing flashes of lightning and peals of thunder.
It made me think, when we first were reading about this, of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Remember where they find somebody ignores the advice and they open the ark and people melt? And there's all this strange, at the time, amazing special effects.
Yeah, it's also been forever memorialized in an amazing GIF that you can drop whenever someone says something crazy. Throw down the one of the Nazi's face melting off and his eyes bugging out.
There we go. This account, we should also mention, I'm glad you brought up Henry Muhlenberg, because Geisler didn't tell the pastor about this immediately after, right? It was a number of years.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. But this Philly Voice article does a really good job of pointing out how this sounds a whole lot more like a kind of literary device rather than an actual account, you know? Mm-hmm. They compare it to King Arthur asking his follower to throw Excalibur into the lake, and then the Lady of the Lake reaches aloft and grabs Excalibur, you know what I mean? Like, they would have known about those stories.
Yeah, they were well read.
Yeah, but it's very odd that he would tell this very specific and quite incredible account. That to what end? Mm-hmm. To help spread the mythos of this this mystic, you know?
Yeah, that's the interesting question, because obviously they were quite educated for the time. They were aware of folklore. They would understand the connections. Oh, and I can't believe we forgot the fun fact there. These guys are famous for another reason, because Christopher Witt in 1705 painted Kelpius, and it's believed to be the oldest oil painting in the U.S.
Oh, I didn't catch that.
It has nothing to do with magic or allegations thereof.
You know, art is its own kind of magic and its own reward.
That's awesome. That's a good way to look at it. So this account may be fictitious. It may be solely a legend.
Yeah, and this speculation is coming from a historian from the Historical Society of Pennsylvania by the name of Dan Rolfe, who was interviewed for this piece on PhillyVoice.com that was written by John Kopp, who's a staff writer for Philly Voice. So where does that leave us today? I do have one other thing. I did see this video that I was talking about earlier that it's kind of cool for a point, and then it really starts to get into like, and he was totally looking for aliens, and ooh. Ben Franklin liked it was believed in aliens too, and Ben Franklin supposedly got possession of all of the relics and remaining materials that were ever in this cave, but I found no mention of that anywhere, of any connection between Ben Franklin, other than the fact that the American Philosophical Society, which was founded by Ben Franklin, does have two books of Kelpius's in their library. One of them is the Diarium of Magister Johannes Kelpius, and that is from 1917, reprinted, so it's not even an original. And then they also have the Journal of Johannes Kelpius, Magister of the Hermits on the Ridge in Pennsylvania, 1694, 1708. So those two, I think, are the only surviving actual accounts from Kelpius himself.
Yeah.
A lot of there maybe was some other correspondence or something like that, but it was not a whole lot. None of his actual philosophy is codified in any kind of like expansive works, you know?
Right. It's those are the two books that we're aware of. There is one other, I thought, fascinating paranormal story, if we want to continue getting
about
Kelpius. Okay, so we said that after his death, the brotherhood, the society dwindles down. At one point, there are just six, let's call them hardcore monks, zealots, ardent believers. And they were led by a guy named Conrad Mathai. Let's go with that.
Yeah, like, Mathai.
There we go. Perfect. But eventually the group starts breaking down further and further and further. And that guy we mentioned, Christopher Witt, who moved to Germantown, he also quit the group, but he continued a lot of his hobbies that he had from his time in the group. And he did pretty well. By 1718, he was a wealthy man. He had bought over 120 acres of land, but he was always under suspicion in town of being, get this, Noel, a Hexenmeister.
Is it like a witchy dude?
Yeah. So people thought he was maybe using his magic, his magical abilities or his esoteric wisdom to get ahead in the secular world. And they also continued to provide services of a paranormal or spiritual type to the community. This guy I just mentioned, Conrad Mathai, cast horoscopes. He performed exorcisms. He said he could travel outside of his own body. There was a book called The Pietist of Provincial Pennsylvania. Written by a guy named Julius Sache, who says the following about Conrad. A captain's wife allegedly asked Conrad in 1740 when he could expect her husband's ship to return. So the guy goes into his chamber, lays down in a trance for an hour. Then he wakes up, he comes back in, and he tells this lady her husband is at a London coffee house and he's preparing to set sail for the New World. And when the captain returns, you know, several months later, whatever, he meets Conrad. And then the first thing he says, again, according to this story, is that he was in a London coffee house and saw the dude, Conrad himself, staring at him.
Mm.
And he said he remembered the encounter because apparently the old man, Conrad, had come up and yelled to him about not writing to his wife. That's got to be total malarkey.
Rude.
But what a great story.
Yeah, that's a good one. Good way to cap this one off. Mm. You got anything else?
You know what? I think we can call it a—oh, no— Do you hear that?
Really?
Oh, man.
It's been so long.
We had such a streak going.
It's time.
Jonathan Gentlemen. Strickland.
It's been so long.
Jonathan Strickland, the Quister. You've been working on that laugh,
it's
huh?
Really you.
I've been celebrating, gentlemen.
I've been missing you. Celebrating. It's weird.
Have you?
It's like the way you miss a sharp pain in your side.
Right, where suddenly you wake up one morning and you think, huh, that's different.
Yeah.
It's not... I kind of miss it now. Mm-hmm. That's very sweet of you.
Day after the chiropractor kind of longing.
Well, just consider me your spinal adjustment of love. Here I am.
All right.
To give you yet another perplexing scenario, whereupon you must decide whether or not it is truth or fiction within the span of 30 minutes.
You know, I put forth a perplexing scenario or a notion that My theory is that we haven't seen you for so long because you're going around and messing with other podcasts that we don't know about.
Is that true?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Have you been podcast cheating on us, man?
Listen, Ben.
Hey, now.
Hey.
Listen, Ben. Things are complicated right now. Check my Facebook status.
Oh, man.
It's just, you never know when someone needs to be, you know, shown up by having to prove their ability and their proposed strengths.
I have defended you on this show.
Listen, Ben. Listen.
No.
Mortgages don't pay themselves, Ben. All right.
You know what?
Quister caves don't come cheap.
It's the most cringeworthy segment in all of podcasting yet again. And of course, here we have recently celebrated the 4th of July.
That is true.
I think, in fact, today is the 5th of July.
Mm-hmm. It is, in fact, as we record this, the 5th of July. Mm-hmm. And so the question today, our scenario today, has to do with someone who was very much connected to the Declaration of Independence. Mm. And so you will get your scenario. The timer will start at 3 minutes. You will, of course, have to ask questions of me. And I always
confuse that one with the Constitution. Is that going to be a problem?
We will see. Okay. But in order to ask a question this time, I always give you an arbitrary rule.
Yes.
This time, if you wish to ask a question to me, you must first say, "Sit down, John."
All right.
It's a reference to a musical called 1776. Go watch it, Noel.
All right.
I might learn a thing or two. Here's your scenario. Prepare yourself and start the timer when I am done.
Hang on, let me warm up, because as longtime listeners know, I have to get a running start to jump and hit the second hand of this grandfather clock we spent so much money on.
Yeah, if you could get the touch screen on that grandfather clock activated and just unlock it now so that you can type in the number. Here we go.
We're working live, man.
Along with Dr. Lyman Hall and George Walton, Button Gwinnett signed the Declaration of Independence representing the colony of Georgia. He would return to Georgia to serve as president. He also maintained a rivalry with Lachlan McIntosh, a Scotsman who served in the American Army as a brigadier general, which was a position that Gwinnett had coveted. Gwinnett commanded McIntosh to conduct an invasion of East Florida during the Revolution. The invasion was a terrible failure. The two men blamed one another for the fiasco, and it all resulted in a duel. However, on the morning the duel was to take place, in southern Georgia, near the border of Florida, as Button Gwinnett walked his way to Lachlan McIntosh, he was bitten by a venomous snake, suspected by historians to be a coral snake. And while the bite itself might not have been fatal, the medical attention that was given to him certainly was, and he died of infection a week and a half later. Start the clock.
All right, we are start. Give me a running start. Boom. Okay. Sit down, John.
Yes, Mr. Bolin.
Could you tell us again where this duel allegedly took place?
Southern Georgia, not too far from the border of Florida.
Okay.
Near what is now known as Fort McIntosh, as it turns out.
And Button Gwinnett, so we know there's a Gwinnett County.
We know about Button. I remember him from Georgia history as a boy. You know?
And McIntosh is a common name for institutions here in Georgia.
I always confuse Button Gwinnett with Oglethorpe, though. Just like I do the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution. I am a really bad historian.
You know, we're not bad, Noel. We're ridiculous.
Oh, that's right.
That's our whole thing.
That's kind.
So,
one thing I don't remember from Georgia history is hearing anything about a snake-bitten Button Gwinnett.
Also, coral snakes. That's standing out to me. I am very tempted to just go false.
Yeah.
You want to just...
Well, sit down, John.
There we go.
Yes.
Is the kicker that he died from poor medical... Like, it's been so long. Are we trying to discern if, like, any detail of the story is true, if the whole thing is not true? If you're saying he died from poor medical attention, but then there was a detail in there that wasn't true.
Any one detail there could make this statement false.
That is how that works.
Yeah. So it is either all true or all false, or there's some falsehood in it. But if there's just some falsehood in it,
it is still inherently false.
It is inherently false.
All or nothing.
So it's all or nothing.
I'm locking in false, babies.
All right.
Me personally. I need you to.
Let's count it down and make it official, bro. Mm-hmm. Three, two, one. False.
Gentlemen, you have defeated me finally. I believe now I'm only three ahead.
Okay. Well, you know, one day at a time, man.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, Casey, can you play some victory music?
Make it a dirge, Casey. A dirge. So here are the actual facts.
Yes.
There was a duel.
There was a duel.
I remember that.
Button Gwinnett did wish to be Brigadier General at the American Revolutionary War. Lachlan McIntosh, his political rival, got that. And then when he returned to Georgia, he was first elected Speaker of the House of Georgia, mm-hmm. as well as Commander-in-Chief of the Georgia Forces. And he did, in fact, order McIntosh to invade East Florida, a British colony.
Uh-huh.
It did not go well because McIntosh did not have the resources needed. He returned to Georgia, and then he proceeded to badmouth Button Gwinnett in front of the Georgia Assembly.
You don't go badmouthing Button in front of his own assembly, man.
A duel was arranged. McIntosh totally shot Button Gwinnett.
Uh-huh.
And Button Gwinnett died about 3 days later on May 19th, 1777. A signer of the Declaration of Independence shot by a soldier who served in the Revolutionary Army.
So no coral snakes whatsoever.
No coral snakes.
No
he
snakes
was not,
at
not,
all.
Not bitten by a snake. He was merely shot by a Scotsman.
Shot by a Scotsman.
Just as fatal as it turns out.
I'm interested. Maybe I missed this. How did the Scotsman end up fighting for the American cause?
He was given the position of Brigadier General. So they were both up for consideration for Brigadier General.
They were rivals.
And Button Gwinnett was passed over. Button Gwinnett's closest ally was Dr. Lyman Hall. And as you mentioned, we have a Gwinnett County. We also have a Hall County.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That is where I am from. Hall County.
Okay.
Oh, getting to know you. Is that where your lair is?
In Hall County? Yeah. No. Heavens no. I'm an old Fourth Ward man now.
Well, Jonathan, what a tremendous pleasure to have finally started winning some of these, right, Noel?
I know, but I'm not getting enough remorse from you. I'm not sensing.
I'm still three ahead.
Well,
man.
I know, but I almost feel like you threw us a little bit of a softball with this one. And while I appreciate it, I also somewhat resent it.
Oh, well, then I'll come at you extra hard next time.
So what will happen next, ridiculous historians? Will the tension continue to simmer? Will we get closer and closer to an even score or fall further into the hole? There's only one way to find out. Well, there are several, but there's one way we would like you to find out.
Yeah, you know, listen to the show.
subscribe to my Twitter feed. You'll find out about it.
Hey, now.
Yeah, hey, what's this other show?
I'm not at liberty to say.
No, what's the other show?
I have no idea.
Oh, you guys are making me so paranoid.
No, that's fine. That's part of the whole interaction here is paranoia. But seriously, thank you for coming again, Jonathan Strickland, the devious quister. We appreciate it / resent it heavily.
Thanks for helping us learn stuff, man.
That's true.
Love you too.
And thank you, folks, for tuning into the show. We hope you'll join us next time where we talk about a bunch of states that never were, that have a lot of fun names and stories. And just listen to the episode. It'll be good. In the meantime, you can write to us at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. You can check us out on the typical social media channels. Our preferred method of communication with our Ridiculous Historian community is through our Facebook group of that very name, Ridiculous Historians. And we actually just came out with an episode that featured some stuff from that very community, and we had a really good time doing it, and we'll probably do it again. So check that out, and drop some memes or stories or questions or ideas on there. You might hear it in an episode.
Yes, and you may well hear from us, from Casey, Noel, and myself. Big thanks, of course, as always, to super producer Casey Pegram. Big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed the track. You know what? Big thanks to everybody.
Except Jonathan.
Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis. Jonathan, you're making a stink face.
Yeah, I love you too, Noel.
Oh, guys, I'm feeling the emanations of affection here. This is
enmity.
Awesome.
Enmity is what you're feeling.
Well, the course of true love never did run smoothly.
Lee.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone.
Goodbye.